Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network, the pop culture for NPR Illinois Community Voices. And I am your host today, Craig. I'm joined today by two co-hosts, Ms. Vanessa Ferguson.
Hello.
And our illustrious editor-in-chief, Mr. Jeremy Gechner.
I'm back. I'm not dead yet.
We have such a thrilling interview to bring you today, and just a wonderful creative mind that we are thrilled to have gotten the chance to speak to. And we're going to talk to you today with Tamsin Merchant. Vanessa, your thoughts on the interview?
Oh, I'm just so excited to speak with her. I'm a huge Pride and Prejudice fan, which was one of her first films. And of course, she has done remarkable things since then. She's written this wonderful book, but I can't deny I'm very excited just to sneak in a Pride and Prejudice question or two. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Jeremy, are you looking forward to this interview?
Yeah, in much the same way, Vanessa, I worshipped that Pride and Prejudice movie when it came out because that score by Dario Marianelli just lived in my head
beautiful.
For forever.
And
the way they filmed that, it was just amazing. But yeah, but I recently finished The Tudors, which is where I know her most from, where she played one of Henry's wives, Catherine Howard, and an absolutely fascinating person in history. And her portrayal of her was quite engrossing and quite I don't know what impact making on me when I watched it. So I'm very much looking forward to talking to her about that, but also the book. The book is just great. The book is just really great. I love that I'm really looking forward just to get into her mind on how she made this magical world and how anybody makes a world this like fleshed out like that.
That's right. You may know Tamsin as an actress because of Pride and Prejudice and The Tudors, and of course, Carnival Row on Amazon going on right now. But you may not know that she just recently published her first book, The Hatmakers, and it is wonderful. It is so magical. It's great. We all had the chance to read or listen to it recently. We'll discuss all of that with her coming up. And I just want to get right into the interview. I'm excited about this. So without further ado, here's Tamsin Merchant. We are thrilled to welcome to the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices podcast, Tamsin Merchant. How are you today, Tamsin?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, before we get into the questions, I actually wanted to pay you a compliment and reference an interview that you did in December for a podcast called Pivot Points. It's one of the things I listen to kind of as we're researching not only your new book, The Hatmakers, but also researching the questions we're going to come up with. And I have to tell you, it's great, a great listen about all things creativity and sort of that process that you go through. And so I can't recommend it enough to our listeners to also check out this interview as kind of a compliment to what we're going to talk to you about today. But it's called Pivot Points, and you did it all on creativity. It was wonderful. You can find it wherever you find podcasts, I'm sure. But thank you for that. It was a really cool discussion that you had.
Thanks for the compliment. I love compliments. I collect them. and yeah, it was a great discussion about creativity. And Andre, the guy who runs Pivot Points, who came up with it. It was such a great idea for a podcast, I thought, to kind of try and locate that exact moment when something in life kind of shifts. And yeah, it was a really interesting kind of exploration for me, actually, to kind of try and describe and explain how it came about that I wrote my book. So thank you. Thanks for the compliment.
Absolutely. And that was, you provided such a great tease that now everyone's going to go and listen to that right after they're done with this. But we're going to get right into the questions. And actually, Vanessa has our first question.
Yeah, so you have a degree in education studies, and you're clearly a very gifted writer. So we were wondering, how does your education influence how you write for young people? Do you have a particular outlook when you're writing for children?
Well, that's a great question. So there's this thing in England where you try and get children to read for pleasure, which is, I think, a really important thing, especially when in our kind of a lot of our mainstream education, it can be quite results driven and quite exam driven. So I think I felt when I was writing The Hat Makers that I wanted to, I didn't really have this reading for pleasure initiative really in mind, but I think something in my soul really felt like I needed to give children something that they could take and kind of feel like they could be part of the book, as well as and have it for the sheer adventure of reading and the adventure of the story. And then I also wanted to kind of put little Easter eggs and messages in the book for children that kind of will help them to affirm themselves, like their own magic and their own creativity. And I kind of wanted to give these messages both quite overtly and also sort of woven into the fabric of the book about how we all as individuals have a unique creative gift. And that could be so many things. But for me, I think in a lot of education systems, the teachers are amazing and often overstretched. And I think that it can become a little bit about the exams and what we as people can kind of, what we as citizens and as learners can sort of, what we can produce usefully in air quotes, but so I think I kind of wanted to also bring and kind of gift to children that their uniqueness and that is part of their kind of their magic and their creativity. That's a big ramble of an answer. I'm so sorry.
Well, it's so on point though, because even myself, I go back to a lot of the books now that we were assigned to read in school, mm-hmm. and some of the great pieces of American literature like Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer and To Kill a Mockingbird. These are stories that we had to read in middle school or high school, but because I wasn't necessarily picking them up for pleasure, I was sort of seeing it as an assignment. And I understand why you have to do that in an educational system. You have to expose children to these works, but I think you're right on there. And speaking of pleasures, I know we mentioned that this book is written for middle school age children, but certainly as adults, you get a lot out of this story as well. And so Jeremy has a question for you.
Yeah. Hi, Tamsin. Hi. We all of us just love the book, and particularly I really love the story of how you created Cordelia Hatmaker. So, I know you've told it before, but would you mind retelling that for our audience here of how you came up with this character?
Yeah, of course. Well, I came up with the idea for the book in a dream that I had. So I had this dream. I was filming Carnival Row, which incidentally is not for kids. Don't let children watch it. It's about fairies, but it's definitely, should come with a health warning. So I was filming this show and it's set in kind of Victorian steampunk era, kind of vibe and in a fantasy world. And there are these amazing costumes and the costume designer was making these really amazing hats. She made one particular hat for David Jesse, who has horns in the show because he's a fawn, and she made this special hat to fit over his horns. And then she was talking about it in this costume fitting I had. And then that night I had this dream about magical hat makers who have a rivalry with the bootmakers, and they have to make special hats for the king, and there's a shipwreck, and this is all in my dream. And then I woke up at 4:30 in the morning and I woke my boyfriend up, who is a very patient man, and I told him all about this dream, and he told me to write it down, and I did. And then I took it to a very extreme conclusion of writing it down into a book rather than just writing it down on my notepad. So that's how I came up with the story. It came to me almost fully formed, not the story itself, but the idea came fully formed in a dream. And then it did take me 2 years to write a good enough draft for it to be published. So yeah, I definitely wouldn't want people who have literary aspirations to think, it's a bit obnoxious, isn't it, to be like, oh, I had a dream and I wrote it down and it's now a book. It's that's a bit Disney princess. It's much more like going to the mines every day for a couple of years and eventually kind of chiseling out a book.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you talk about the influences that you had because you saw these beautiful costumes and hats from Carnival Row. Does the book take inspiration from other areas of your life experiences that you've brought into your writing?
Well, definitely the actor who appears in in the book, Sir Hugo Gushforth, may or may not be based on one or more persons that I have experienced in my career, but I'm sure my lawyers, if I had them, would tell me not to admit that. Sir Hugo is definitely, I wanted to kind of give an affectionate, but also sort of satirical view of actors, being one myself and adoring them and being, you know, frustrated by them in equal measure sometimes. So yeah, Sir Hugo is definitely based on some people. And I think there are parts of Cordelia that are quite like me. But I think she's also kind of, I don't know, maybe she's this idealized version of me. And also I was trying to make her not too obedient, because I think sometimes girls especially, but children of all genders maybe get told that obedience is a good thing. And I think respect is a really good thing, but I think obedience, if it's kind of hammered into you as a child, I think it can be a bit of a damaging message to give to children. So, I mean, I'm not proposing anarchy in middle schools, but I think I wanted to make sure that Cordelia didn't play by the rules always.
That's right. We can all, they can all rise up in the lunchroom, right?
And yes, exactly.
Take over the schools. That's wonderful. The way that you get around this is you just send those actors that you're thinking of, the book randomly and just say, you know, you were such an inspiration in my career. And so that way you don't have to tell them exactly what the inspiration was. But Vanessa, you have the next question.
Yes. And I think what you said about children having that experience of needing to be obedient leads well into this. So it seems more and more important today that young adult novels allow those young eyes, those readers, to see themselves in the story. So we wanted to ask you, did you take that into consideration when writing The Hatmakers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so in The Hatmakers, I made the conscious decision not to describe the physical appearance of anyone. And I think I'm pretty sure that nothing snuck in, you know, that no actual physical attributes snuck in. And this was for several reasons. I mean, I always imagine myself and I imagine just people, the kind of spirit of the character is more important than what they look like. And I think sometimes if the spirit comes through and then you get told by the author, oh, this person has, you know, blonde hair and you always picture them with dark hair or whatever it might be, then that can be slightly jarring. And I wanted children reading the book to really feel like this was as much theirs as it is mine. Like I remember when I was little kind of realizing, it was like kind of achieving object permanence, but just achieving the knowledge that there are authors of books and the books aren't just these magical kind of tomes that sort of come in from another dimension and just tell a story. I realize that they're sort of written by authors. And, but what I've realized now becoming an author is that you write the book and then you send it out into the world and it becomes everyone's who reads it. So I may have written it, but it belongs to everyone. And so I didn't want any child reading the book to feel like they couldn't be Cordelia or Goose or Sam or any of the characters. So I made a conscious decision not to describe any of their sort of physical appearance and tried to concentrate on the spirit. And also, you know, I can't, this is a bit of a, it's a sort of very difficult question, difficult thing to talk about, especially as a white writer. I didn't want to kind of, I didn't want to leave out, especially because it's set in Georgian England, which would have been a predominantly white society. But I didn't want to leave out children of different ethnicities, but I also didn't want to try to sort of appropriate and bring in different ethnicities in a kind of appropriating way. So I think I had to be, I was trying to be very mindful, and I may not have, you know, have pleased everyone. And, but my main aim was to be as inclusive as possible, but without trying to appropriate any other cultures or ethnicities. So yeah, it was a challenge, but my main thing was wanting to make sure that children who read the book can see themselves or whoever they want, or their friends, or whoever they like, kind of in the pages and imagine themselves.
That's really cool that you consciously thought of that and as you're writing, because the rest of your words paint such a beautiful picture of the setting and of the land that we're in. You know, when you as a reader are asked to transport yourself into a fantasy, you do still need some of those stepping stones to get you into that. And and your book certainly provides that. It provides such a nice entry into this fantastical world that you came up with. And it's just beautifully written from that standpoint. And I guess I didn't necessarily notice that there you had left out the descriptors of the characters. And I guess that's a good thing that I maybe didn't notice that, because it's kind of like you said, kids reading this can pick this up and really truly see themselves in the characters, which I think is just a wonderful way to go about that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's my hope.
Yeah. Jeremy, you had a question.
Yeah. So, one thing that this world, this magical world is just so marvelous that you've crafted in this book. One of the ideas that is so great is that these hats can instill, powers, or at the very least, some increased ability, in some way. So fun little question here for you though, but let's put a hat on Tamsin here. Ooh. What ability would you instill upon yourself there if you could?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I should have a very pithy answer prepared, but I don't. I'd like the ability to feel more keenly what other people are feeling at that time. So like a sort of empathy hat would be, you'd have to be able to take it off because it would be quite a lot to be able to, to feel that all the time. But I think to be able to sort of put a hat on and to feel really heart to heart with someone would be quite an amazing thing. If that's not too cheesy.
No, absolutely. Well, I totally agree with you, because I think we can all agree, if there's one thing the world always needs more of, it is empathy. feeling and seeing the world through certain people's eyes and other people's eyes and feeling. So I think that's a great answer.
Oh, thank you.
I was going to say, I know that you're in London now. We have about 340 million people here in America. So if you could start mass producing those hats.
Yeah, those empathy hats, we could really use some.
Cordelia could start getting that going for us.
I definitely won't make them red based baseball caps.
Oh, there it is.
Good idea. So I love reading, but I'm very slow at it. So I will tell you that I think actually all three of us, we wanted to make sure we checked this book out and got the whole story. And so all of us purchased the book on Audible. And what's great about that is that you are also our narrator through this. Yes. So I wanted to ask about that process of bringing your text to us vocally. And, of course, your experiences as an actor, kind of how that played into it. But also, do you feel like narrating it in that way, or storytelling in that way, did it bring you closer to your characters? Is there a greater sense of accomplishment that you have for your first work, because you were able to also speak it as well to us? I know I put in like six questions in there, so please feel free to answer whatever you'd like.
That's a really interesting set of questions. I really enjoyed doing all the voices. So I really enjoyed kind of getting into Cordelia and Goose especially. I think it made me feel, especially when Cordelia is having an argument with something, with someone, it made me definitely feel like, yeah, Cordelia's right. I was very kind of on her side when I was doing the narration. It was really fun. I just sat in a booth for 2 days and read the book pretty much solidly in several hour chunks, you know, and it was quite an intense experience actually, because not only are you sort of in this hermetically sealed booth with the headphones on and the microphone right there and the kind of words that I meticulously worked over and over and over for 2 years in front of me on an iPad. It's kind of just this hermetically sealed bubble. And it was almost like being in an isolation tank with my book, which is quite an intense experience. But yeah, I really enjoyed doing all the voices. That was a lot of fun. And I sort of, some of the voices surprised me actually. Mr. Darebottom surprised me a bit, and Great Aunt Petronella was a lot of fun to do. So yeah, I think I did loads and loads of facial expressions and waved my arms around and hit the microphone a few times, and we had to go and do retakes. But yeah, it was such a good couple of days.
Well, and as I mentioned, you're so great at bringing these characters to us, but I'm wondering about even that process. Is that something that the publisher recommends to you because you also have a acting career, a name associated with your book as well? Or is this something that you wanted to do to also narrate, or kind of how did that work out?
I think I pretty much just demanded to do the narration. And they're like, okay. So I was very keen to do it. So I'd done one book before. I did Meg Rosoff's Picture Me Gone, which is an amazing book. Meg's an amazing writer. But yeah, this is only the second book I'd ever done, so I didn't have a lot of experience. But we had 4 days set aside to record it, and I actually did it in 2. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, I think I was just like, I know this. It's in my blood. And I just went for it.
That's excellent. And it's wonderful. So I would definitely recommend to our listeners that this is, of course, available at all your local bookstores, but you can also get it on places like Audible if you wanted to hear the audio version of it as well. Vanessa, you have our next question.
One thing I found really remarkable about the books was all the little details. And in fact, there's a glossary at the end of the book that describes the different items a hat maker can use to make a hat more magical. And I wondered, how do you keep that all straight in your mind? Do you also use the glossary?
I have actually referred to the glossary several times to just check that what I'm doing is allowed within the kind of magical lore. My sister helped me with all the Latin in the glossary, because there are you get the sort of given name of bit like a plant, and then the Latin name, and then a description of what the magical object does. And yeah, that was fun. And also something that I love in the book that they put in is this space at the end with blank pages for the owner of the book, who might be a budding hat maker themselves, to write down ingredients that they might find on their travels, their own magical ingredients. So that was important. I think it's in the American edition. I hope it is. I'm pretty sure. So.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It's really cool to see all of the, I mean, again, just the idea that the creativity it takes to be able to, like you said, come from a dream and then through hours and hours of work, bring that to fruition, and for us to be able to enjoy that. It's just incredible. Can't compliment enough there. But Jeremy, your question?
Yeah. So I'm not going to give anything away or anything, but the book, you're right. Well, it's allowed for you, I think. but you know, I love that the book ends with a mystery, you know, and that we've got a little bit further that it seems like we have to go here. It has me really eager to see if there's a next one. Do we have more books coming in the Hatmaker series? And if so, do you have a number in your head already of how many you think you're going to go?
I have, so I'm writing The Map Makers at the moment, which is a sequel.
Yes.
Yeah. But at the moment, I've got, what I'm trying to do, and this is a challenge, just from a kind of mechanical perspective, which is really interesting and a bit of a puzzle for me, which I love, is trying to make sure that the book, the map makers, feels whole and satisfying. And also there's a place for it to go beyond that. Mm. But, you know, I hope people really enjoy the hat makers. And if they do, then I'll definitely write more after the map makers. But I want to make sure that the map makers feels complete and whole and doesn't leave people doesn't leave people hanging on a cliffhanger too much.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a balance between kind of, leaving a thread. Kind of want to finish the whole tapestry and then leave one thread to be pulled at the end. So
yeah,
that's the plan and the challenge.
Well, it worked for me. I'm very much there. I was very satisfied with this book, but I'm like, I want more. I want to go there. And you know, like, for any film studios executives listening, would make a great film or TV series. I'm just saying, let's get that going there. But you know, you've created this, you're working on the next one. Do you think that now you have that bug, are you going to keep going with children's books and series after even this series?
Absolutely. Yeah. I actually have an idea for a prequel as well. Nice. Yeah, I have an idea. I have ideas for a prequel, a sequel, and a standalone book in the same world. So maybe not the same characters, but then I just love Cordelia and Goose and Sam so much that I would never want to stop writing their stories. So yeah, I've got the bug massively. I've been bitten by a magical hat making bug.
There it
hat
is.
Making book writing bug.
Fantastic.
We're excited to see where the Tamsinverse goes from here, right?
Yes. Hashtag yeah. Tamsinverse.
So you've talked about leading from your instincts and having a beginner's mind, meaning that you're not afraid to try new things. And reading about your career and education, you've gotten to try so much. You've, of course, a successful actor, director, writer. What else do you think you might try in the future?
Well, I'm always trying gardening. That's always really fun. And I, as you may have read, I'm very bad at painting, but I will continue that. I will continue my abstract portraits of sheep into, you know, hopefully the rest of my life. For me, I'm really excited to try directing a feature film. I think that to me is a really exciting idea. I think storytelling in every way that we do it, like that's the thing about storytelling, is that it's sort of infinite and it can just be, it can be through so many different mediums. So I think making something is kind of a story, telling a story, whether you're making something with your hands or you're kind of making a story with words or you're making a picture. Like, I just think telling stories is the thing that I'm gonna hopefully continue to try for the rest of my life. That's my plan.
That's excellent. It's a wonderful plan. And we as an audience get to, reap the rewards of that plan. So I appreciate that quite a bit. Now, we of course want to talk to you about your acting career as well. And, but I know you've done a lot of different press and interviews around your first book here. And so I wanted to slide in a question that just is, have you wanted to talk something about this book or speak to something about this book that you haven't been asked to this point, that you wanted to just get some more information out there or get some story out there that you have? And not to put you on the spot at all, I just want to make sure that you get to tell that story as you're bringing your first book to publish here.
Thank you. I think that we sort of touched on earlier, we touched on for the first time, how children can kind of see themselves, how I'd really like the children to see themselves in the book. That to me is really important. And I haven't really spoken about that before, which was lovely to talk about. I think as well, what I felt while writing the book was that I'd like children who read the book, and children of all ages, so people the inner child of adults who read this, to feel like what they have to say and contribute and what they have to kind of make with their own hands and their own minds and their own kind of inner magic, that's really important. And that if you put your heart and your soul into whatever it is that you're doing, whether that's, you know, writing a story or writing a song or playing a sport that you love, you know, whatever it is, if you bring your magic to it, that it's a really important thing that the world needs. I think we all need to do the sort of inner work of contacting our inner magic and connecting with it. And then, so that's the inner work, and then the outer work is like bringing it out into the world and having the courage to share that with each other as well. And that is really where our world starts to be, how we start to change our world. That is how we change our world, is by connecting with our inner magic and kind of growing it like it's a little bean, and then you grow it into a giant beanstalk, and then you kind of you share your magic with people around you. And it can be scary, you know, it can be scary to share your inner magic, because it's quite vulnerable, but I think it's also wonderful. And so I like people who read the book to feel that they've got an ally in me for that, and that they can be inspired to kind of show the world their inner magic that they've adventured into their heart and their head and their belly. That's what Prospero says. And they found their magic in there, and they're willing to share it.
Wow. Just beautifully, beautifully said. And I should say that going into this next question, I've known Vanessa now for about a decade. And when we mentioned that this interview was a possibility and talked to her about it, I think that this question might have made her the most excited I have ever seen her. So she is going to ask you a bit about Pride and Prejudice.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm really sorry for all the fangirling that's about to happen here. The Pride and Prejudice, it was your first film, and I remember watching it in the theater as a teen, and I fell in love with it. It's beautiful, the characters are wonderful, and the music is beautiful. So I want to ask you, what was that experience like? And I noticed in the extras that many of the characters or the actors got to play hide and seek as kind of a bonding moment. So I wondered if you got to do that too.
Oh, sadly, I didn't get to play hide and seek. I know. I think that was the Bennett sisters, and I was being Miss Darcy, who was considered possibly a bit of a snob through a lot of the film, so we luckily meet her and realize that she's not. But Miss Darcy, Georgiana, didn't get to play hide and seek.
Oh,
she was by herself playing the piano in a whole different house. But yeah, doing Pride and Prejudice was absolutely transformational for me. And I kind of talking about, you know, connecting with our inner magic, like that for me was one of the first moments that I really did that myself. I was reading the book and I cold called the casting director of Pride and Prejudice, because I was reading the novel. I was 17. I was just like, really keen to go out into the world and do something. And this book was, it felt special and a way into something. So I was reading it, and my mom happened to point out that there'd been some announcement about how Keira Knightley was going to be Elizabeth Bennet in this new version. So I did some Nancy Drew style detective work, found out who the casting director was, found her phone number and called her up and like announced that I wanted to audition for this film. And she let me, she was like, "Oh, who are you?" And I was like, "No one." But I faxed a picture of myself into them, and they invited me in for an audition. And I got the part after three auditions. And I can still remember stepping onto set for the first time ever in my career and just feeling like this was the place I wanted to be. It was just wonderful. I spent for the 2 months leading up to my 2 days on set, I spent half of that time learning the piano pieces that I played.
Yes. And
my poor family were just like haunted by this beautiful music. Luckily it was beautiful. I slightly murdered it, but it was beautiful. Dario Marinelli just wrote the most wonderful music, and
yeah,
it was transformational for me. And I knew that when I finished that part, I was like, I've got to do that again. It's a bit like riding a roller coaster. You get off. Well, I'm scared of roller coasters, but you get off at the end and you're like, wow, I got to do that again. And that's how I felt when I finished that job. And yeah, I was very lucky, incredibly lucky. But yeah, you just got to follow your instinct into those things. And that's what I did.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that you learned to play the piano, because that's what I was going to ask you. Because after the movie came out, the score is just so beautiful. I went out and bought the piano music, and the pieces you played are not exactly easy. So I commend you for playing them. And it's just a favorite. I can't wait to tell everybody. I know I'm like, I talked to someone from the movie.
Well, I got the tenacity to just be, you know, have that much confidence in yourself to say, I want to put myself out there for this. And that's mm-hmm. a great message for these kids as well, that you're writing to, or you're, you know, mm-hmm. the fact that you can kind of pick up that phone and do that. And then that helped open so many doors for you. It's just wonderful. But we actually have, what we did was we asked some of our listeners if they wanted to give us some questions to ask you. Ooh, and great. One of the first ones comes from, it was kind of, we almost received two very similar questions. And they were from Courtney and Anne, and they have a question that Jeremy's going to ask you.
Right. So Courtney and Anne, obviously another thing that a lot of people probably know you from is the Tudors, the show. Actually, my wife and I just got finished watching the Tudors. We're a little behind a few years ago. But we absolutely loved your portrayal of Catherine Howard in that. And, you know, Courtney and Anne specifically wanted to know, you know, looking back in your role as her on that show, did you feel like the writers were fair to that character? And did you, you know, would you now with hindsight, would you change anything about that performance? Because Catherine Howard is such a, I won't say divisive, but there's so many conflicting things about her in the historical record. And so I'm just fascinated by how you even came up with that, how you rounded that character out. And as Courtney and Anne ask, you know, like, you know, do you think that it was a fair portrayal of her?
That's an interesting question. Thank you, Courtney and Anne, for that question. I think Catherine Howard is... It's a very interesting topic because, okay, so you look at a portrait. I always remember thinking when I was preparing for this role, you look at a portrait of someone back then and they all look so serious. it's a bit like the Victorians, like posing for their photo because it took 15 seconds. They couldn't smile. But see, it took a lot longer to pose for a painting, and nobody kind of looked fun. And I don't think I would change anything about that performance, simply because the way I do all of my acting, because I don't have any formal training, is I just try and follow my nose into it, and I just try and dive in and follow my instincts. And my instincts at that time were telling me Catherine is this young, naive, like life-loving girl who is caught in this sort of cage made by men. She's been used by the men around her. And I think that she was this kind of butterfly trapped in this dark cage. And I think maybe some people think that it was a little frivolous, maybe. I don't know. But I think that what Catherine Howard did was she really lived and she sort of lived while she was alive, and that wasn't for long enough. And and her death was a tragedy, but I think that it was made by those men that the cage that she found herself in was kind of not of her own, obviously not of her own making, but it was such a dark prison that was sort of closing in around her, and she was sort of dancing like a butterfly around a flame almost. And I know that's a mixed metaphor because moths go to flames, but she's more of a butterfly. So, but yeah, and I discovered afterwards, actually, when I went to the Tower of London, that Henry VIII had her, after she was beheaded, he had her body like destroyed. And that made me so sad because she was a young woman. And I think women through history, especially that king, used women. And I think it was so defiant of her to dance, really.
Yeah.
I think sometimes dancing is really the only way to defy what, you know, what cages men or humans, but quite a lot of the time men put around, put around young women. So yeah, that's definitely not to say that I think that my performance or my portrayal was perfect or fair, but I wouldn't change it just because I don't really believe in that changing stuff. So yeah.
No. Absolutely. And there's, you know, like full disclosure, I really started getting into researching Henry VIII and his wives after actually a musical called Six that I saw that was all about them. I'm sure you've probably heard of it. But, you know, most people know about Anne Boleyn. Most people know about, you know, Catherine of Aragon. You know, when I started getting into Catherine Howard, and they really focused in that musical, like, think about this, a young girl with no parents, you know, out there running wild. She's preyed upon by men since she was like 13 years old, 17 years old, finds herself married to this infirmed King of England as his fifth wife. And yeah. And then all of a sudden these people like conspire to take her down. And it's, I just thought like when you entered that show, it was such a breath of fresh air, and that what ultimately, right, because especially those ending scenes where she's in the tower and, you know, this young kid who is so worried and so distraught, and she asks for the block so she can practice laying her head on it, which is a real thing that she did. And the nobility that you did in that scene too. I don't know, more than any other of the queens on that show, your portrayal like stuck with me the most, genuinely. And so I just wanted to tell you that. And, you know, not really a question, just a compliment. It really stuck with me. Like, you know, there's just so much tragedy with this character. And you're right, even the histories treat her not nicely. You know, they treat her more as just a conniving, stupid person. Yeah. And that's just, I just find that so disingenuous.
Yeah, I think that we're so often, it sort of speaks to the ongoing kind of difficulty in how women are seen a lot of the time, kind of, especially in power situations. Like the last female prime minister we had, you know, all the press talked about was what shoes she was wearing and like what her outfits, like no one talks about Boris Johnson's shoes. I mean, for crying out loud. So I think like women get kind of put into certain categories, and you either have to be, you know, dumb or conniving, you know, like, why can't you be joyful and foolish, but also maybe emotionally intelligent? Like the complexity, I think, yeah, it's a constantly evolving thing, but yeah, I don't really know what I'm saying, but I think that the complexity of women, especially in those situations, like Catherine Howard was a person so much more than a rhyme to fit in your divorce, beheaded, die, divorce, beheaded,
slide. I mean,
yeah, it's a whole, and I think we all, you know, right now, let's be real, that's a Me Too situation, what Catherine Howard was in. Like, she was basically to like Harvey Weinstein, which is an absolutely horrendous horrendous prospect. And you can quote me on that. Come at me hard. What are you going to do? Oh, you're unlike a diamond.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, and you're right. Like that's kind of something I always like, you know, at the end of the tutors, I was like, okay, but you know, Henry at this point in his life did not look like Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Yeah. A very sexy man, even with, you know, Henry VIII sort of, they've stuffed his like tights to make his legs look big.
But, right.
Like, Johnny is a very attractive man, and no amount of makeup can really hide that. So, yeah, it was a slight disparity. Yeah, but I love Catherine Howard. I feel a great sadness for her, and yeah. I feel like she's a sister, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you.
Well, you know, to bring into another property that we absolutely love is Carnival Row. And we've had the opportunity, we've been very fortunate to speak to a lot of creative people during the pandemic. And you took your idea, you brought a book to the world during this time. So thank you for that. But I'm wondering about the filming of Carnival Row and how it's, the experience is different on set due to COVID restrictions and things like that. Have you done much filming for season two, and how was that different?
Yeah, frustratingly, COVID kind of put a big pause right in the middle of season two. So we've sort of had this obviously enforced hiatus last spring because of COVID. And then we went back in August and we did a couple of weeks of filming to get sort of halfway through the season. So we've completed half of the season now. And those 2 weeks of filming with COVID restrictions were quite difficult. And I feel for people who are sort of, and I admire people who are sort of trying to make full big shows right now, or full any shows, to be honest, because it's very difficult. Because of the nature of Carnival Row, because there are sort of 100 extras in each scene and things, we've had to sort of, again, take a rain check, but a pandemic check, but hopefully we'll be back at it soon. But yeah, filming in those restrictions is very strange. Yeah, you can't quite relax and just get into it and get into the scene a lot of the time.
As a fan of television and film, it's really interesting for me to try to wrap my head around how this ended up changing the industry and how those standards go forward, because obviously so many aspects of our lives are going to change after this. But it's interesting to be able to discuss that with someone that has seen sort of the beginnings of what that change will be. And so thank you for that. We do have another question that someone submitted to us, and Vanessa has that question. This is from Jonathan through Vanessa.
So Jonathan would like to know, a lot of your arc as Imogene's Burn Rose is taking on issues of classism and racism as you enter into a passionate relationship with the Puck who moved in next door. His race is of a lower class in the world, but he's way more wealthy than her or her brother. So how do you see this fantasy world of Carnival Row addressing some of the social issues we have today?
Ooh, another excellent question. Thank you, Jonathan. I think that what I love about Imogen and Agraeus's relationship is that it's complex, but these two souls find each other. And I think that he sees Imogen and she sees him, and they see each other quite purely once they've got past all of the kind of the external circumstances of their race and their class and their, you know, their different outlooks on life. What I loved playing Imogen. I love playing Imogen because I love how terrible she is at the beginning. She's so obnoxious and horrible, and I really enjoyed that. What can I say? It came very naturally to me. Strange. But I think what David and I don't want to speak for David, Jesse, who plays Mr. Agraeus, as I call him. But what I think what we were trying to do is show that these two people belong together. And even though they maybe didn't expect that, it happened. The love that they feel and that grows between them happens. I should say, spoiler alert, they happens because they see each other's souls. And I think, and they, something, they light something up in each other, which was really exciting to play. And I think that, you know, we're trying to say through that relationship that no matter, you know, what your backgrounds are and what your differences are, if there's love, like you can take on the world together. So that's a really cool story to be telling.
Absolutely. Jeremy, you had another question for Carnival Row fans out there.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember watching Carnival Row when it first came out, and just, you know, obviously I heard the title, like, from the brain of Guillermo del Toro, and I'm like, I'm running. Yeah. I mean, like, anything that comes from his brain, I'm running to see. But, you know, it had such an amazing following, and it still does, that people just really got into this world that was created here. And obviously you've already said, you filmed some of season two, so, you know, we have to ask the question, you know, is there anything you can tell us for the fans? Don't give anything away, don't get in trouble. But you know, like, you've already talked a little bit how you've grown into Imogene there, but, like, you know, can you tell us just anything else that we might be able to be looking forward to for season two?
Okay, so let me think carefully what I can tell you. So Imogene and Reyes get on a ship at the end, mm-hmm. and the ship still hasn't docked at the beginning of season two.
Okay.
And everything is glorious for about 5 minutes. And then things start to go very badly wrong for them. And Imogene is tested in ways that she's never dreamed of being tested before. So, it's a lot of fun to play in season two.
That qualifies.
Yeah, absolutely. What we can do is just watch the first 5 minutes of season two, and then everyone lives happily ever after.
There you go. Great. Everything's good.
You know. that's so great. Vanessa, you actually saw something on YouTube, I think, you wanted to ask her about.
Yeah, well, this is just kind of a fun question for you. But in our research, we found a series of YouTube videos of you trying to live off $1.50 in groceries a day.
Yes.
And there's a saying, celebrities, they're just like us. And I don't think there's ever been a more relatable video series that I've
good.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, what made you want to try living off $1.50 a day?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So when I did the video series about $1.50, that was for Global Citizen. Do you guys know about Global Citizen? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was actually part of Global Citizen when it started at Cambridge University. Hugh Evans was at university at the same time as I was, and he started this amazing, he'd already done like some things with Bono in Australia, and he came over to England and he started this group of students, and we were sort of like testing out this whole new project idea of Global Citizen. And Global Citizen basically is absolutely brilliant. I highly recommend everyone get the app and start getting involved. You can get, when our world hopefully goes back to normal, you can basically earn points on the app by doing social media kind of pressuring of governments and stuff by tweeting and writing and canvassing for sort of like for good causes. You can win points. You earn points rather to get free tickets to music concerts. It's a brilliant, brilliant kind of community and collective. So Global Citizen are doing this thing where you live off $1.50 a day for 5 days to see how people kind of below the poverty line effectively have to live every day. So yeah, I did this series of videos where I was very much trying to take up that challenge, and it's very, very challenging. It's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And it was massively eye-opening. Living on $1.50 a day is a huge challenge, but you can do it and get sponsored for it. And Yeah, I highly recommend everyone gets involved with Global Citizen. You can follow on Instagram and Twitter, and you can get the app. It's a brilliant, brilliant organization, and some amazing, amazing things have been done kind of in the real world through social media kind of pressure effectively and collective action. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's all wonderful. Did you have a follow up there, Vanessa?
The series of videos, there's especially one where you're at the grocery store and you're like, we're going to have to take some items away. I was so anxious and I'm like, oh but don't forget about the taxes. Don't forget. I was like, oh no, Tamsin, you're going to get taxed and you're not going to make it. And so I'm thrilled to hear that there was a really noble cause that kind of put you maybe perhaps through anxiety, put me through anxiety so, watching it. So I definitely, that's something I think our listeners and we should all check out.
Yeah. And I'm sure you can read more about it on the Global Citizen website and stuff. I think it's every May, June time that you can kind of do this with everyone else is doing it as well. And it's quite an amazing thing to sort of, to participate in knowing that other people are doing it around the world as well. So
well, that's wonderful. And we just want to say thank you for your time today. It's so great because I think that we are all about the same age, which means we have the benefit of being able to watch the rest of your career and everything that you're going to come up with. And also it gives us a little bit of a kick to be like, hey, if she's doing this, what can we do?
You know,
yeah, you guys.
You're an actor, an author. You're going to be a director of a feature film in the not too distant future. I just things that it's such a lovely time to talk to you today. So thank you so much for your time.
Lovely. Thank you guys so much for talking and having such amazing questions. And your enthusiasm is wonderful. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm so glad you all enjoyed the book and everything. So yeah.
Absolutely. Would you like to plug where people can follow you or maybe go out and purchase the hat makers?
Yeah. Well, yes, definitely buy the hat makers, wear a mask when you do, or order it online from a local independent bookstore is best. And yeah, I'm on Twitter and Instagram and I'm not very good at either of them, but I do try. So please come and get involved and send me pictures of yourselves wearing magical hats. I'm really keen to hear like what people want for their hats. I'd like to hear what you guys would like to, if you could invent yourselves a magical hat, what would you put on it?
Oh my goodness.
Oh no.
That is a tough question. You know, I do think that there are times in my life where certainly I allow that anxiety to come in and that I'm such an extrovert, and especially during this pandemic, thinking about like, I put way too much stock into what others might be thinking about me and the negative images that I have of that. So not to go all psychotherapy on you here, but I think that I think that some kind of hat that would give me a bit more of that self-confidence boost when I need it. I think that could be really good. So I went first. So you both had time. Vanessa,
I'll take a relaxation hat. I went and got my nails done recently.
Yeah,
thank you. For a show, streaming show, virtual show that I did. And, even the nail tech was like, you must relax. You're making it difficult for me to do this. And and in that moment, I'm like, I am so tense all the time. Look, I noticed. So if you can make me a relaxed hat, I'll take it.
Oh yes, that sounds good.
Mine's pretty easy because you know, I'm the editor in chief of this network and I do a lot of things. I have two kids and I just always never feel like I have enough time to do everything. So I would want a hat that could just slow me down, just slow the world down temporarily for just a little bit so I could, you know, get a little bit more stuff done and not feel like I'm missing things when I choose one or the other.
Oh yeah, that's a tough feeling, isn't it? Oh, those are three excellent hats. I love your hats.
They're yours now for the next book.
That's right. If you need, there can be a trio of podcasters in the map makers.
There you go. Yes. You know,
but thank you so much, Tamsin, for your time. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Of course. Thanks so much for having me, you guys. It's been lovely.
What a fantastic interview. Such a creative person. She was so open with her discussion of how she developed her own world, but then also these roles that she's portrayed as an actress. Just a lot that you can take out of this interview. Vanessa, I want to go to your thoughts first. What are your thoughts about this interview we had with Tamsin?
Oh, well, you know, we've been very lucky to interview a lot of really creative people this past year, and they do not disappoint. I mean, she was just absolutely wonderful. I love the way she thinks, and I adore this book that she's created. It's just a wonderful, magical universe, and I wish we had the second book already. I'm really unconvinced. I want to know what happens. And of course, I'm too shy to ask her to just tell me off camera. But but that's okay. I will look forward to it. And she's just delightful and smart and creative. And I just really loved speaking with her today.
And Jeremy, you not only talked about the book, but you really got into a great conversation with her about the tutors and her portrayal. Your thoughts on the interview?
Yeah. Well, again, just get the book, people. It's fantastic. It's a wonderful read. It's something really great to get lost in right now. You know.
Mention that, you know, because we did say that in the interview that it is marketed for, I think, grades like. It's marketed for 8-year-olds to 12-year-olds in that middle school range, early high school. But truly, three adults here, we thoroughly enjoyed this book.
Yeah.
And there is a lot you can get out of it. And like you said, Jeremy, the escapism of going into a fantasy world right now is very appealing. So sorry to interrupt you, but
The world's gotten a little better, but it still kind of sucks too. escapes the world. But yeah, I was just fascinated by her stuff with the tutors because, again, and we said it in there, so much interesting stuff with Catherine Howard, and that is such a hard historical person to bring to life. And the fact that she was able to kind of amalgam, you know, the historical records of her with the common sense knowledge of what we would think about, you know, a person like that in that situation. It was just really affirming to me that she thought that deeply about it and that she kind of confirmed what I was feeling about Catherine Howard while watching that, which is this is somebody who's just an innocent person that's just crushed by this entire world of deceit and deceptiveness that's closing in around her. And I'm telling you, if you haven't seen The Tudors, it's only like 4 seasons. It's only like 50 episodes or something. It's great. And trust me when I tell you, her performance as Catherine Howard is definitely one of the standouts. It doesn't get as much time as like Natalie Dormer's Anne Boleyn, but it's so impactful. It hits you right there every episode she's in.
I'll definitely have to go and check it out. It's actually one of my blind spots in her career, and I had not seen The Tudors yet. So something that I want to definitely explore, especially after having this conversation. But, you know, I just thankful to her for her time. Can't say that enough. And thankful for her creativity and what she is putting out into the world. And it just was a lovely, lovely chat.
And I think this was the first time that when we've done one of these interviews, they flipped the script and actually interviewed us.
She asked us a question.
I know. I was a little taken aback. I don't know what to say.
Well, that's, you know, it was like one of those where I guess we could have seen it coming, right? We asked her the same question, but it was kind of fun to flip the script and to have to think of that on the fly. But and maybe that's you get that gut reaction like, oh, what is it that I would really love?
And
I
think we all
a question right now.
Yeah, and it's funny because I was remembering the story about your nails that you told us the other day. And so I was thinking like, I kind of nailed that you would get a relaxation and then Jeremy with time. That to me makes sense because you're always juggling so many things all at once.
They never get frustrated with my lack of answering messages because I literally don't have time to even type on a phone.
And you know why he doesn't have time. Part of it is because he's doing so much for the Front Row Network, which, of course, you can follow along on social media. You can find us by searching the Front Row Network everywhere, and also Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. You can find us on NPR Illinois Community Voices as well. We have a lot of great things coming up. I mean, look at these amazing interviews that we've been able to have and bring to you. We're so grateful for that. But Vanessa and I happen to be two-thirds of Beyond the Mouse. So, Vanessa, what do we have coming up on Beyond the Mouse that you wanted to tell them about?
Oh, well, we have a lot of very fun interviews coming up. We're actually on the ball with recording them ahead of time. And one that I think is going to be a very good interview is our 100th episode. We will be celebrating in some way or form and hopefully having some fun guests joining us. So that's definitely something you want to look out for. And you can also go back and look at some of our past episodes. We were very fortunate to interview Evangeline Lilly about her new book as well and her career, and as many of you know, as the Wasp. So we have talked to a Marvel character. We really have. So those are a lot of fun to go back and listen to. And of course, like you said, Craig, we have a lot more in store as the year goes on.
They're really good companion pieces, this interview with Tamsin and that interview with Evangeline, because both of them not only gave us the passion of bringing their literature to us, but also really great, insightful conversations about acting and about film that I certainly, if you haven't heard the Evangeline Lilly interview, certainly go back and listen to that as well. Jeremy, what are you up to? I know Are You Afraid of the Podcast still running strong. I hear that Nickelodeon is bringing back Are You Afraid of the Dark as well. So where are we at with what you're doing over there for the network?
Only always. I mean, it's a perpetual state of rumor with Nickelodeon that they're bringing it back. Of course, they brought back the limited series last year, but there are indeed rumors of a more permanent series coming back. But yeah, Sarah and I will be recording the Tale of Cutter's Treasure, which is a two-part episode on Are You Afraid of the Dark, the original series, starring Academy Award winner Charles S. Dutton, no less. But aside from that, too, though, I do want to just plug that you know, obviously the show that's kind of breaking the internet right now is WandaVision, and we will be coming out with a comprehensive series review of WandaVision. And moving forward, speaking of into March, the next Marvel series on Disney Plus coming out is The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and we will be switching to a weekly limited series on all of the Marvel shows moving forward. So you will be getting every week an episode breakdown of that one. But with WandaVision, we will be doing it just one big one. We made that decision early, and then we kind of regretted it because there's so many things happening in that show. But also coming up in March, want to plug Lou Hare's March Madness Brackets. He is coming up with a doozy for the March Madness Bracket. That's all I'll say for now. Let's just say
that it's going to be fiercely debated. Not to spoil anything, even to Jeremy, breaking news to Jeremy, but he might have gotten Beyond the Mouse in on the fun a little bit too. So
I'm pretty sure he's working on multiple brackets because we're nuts here. But you know, what else do you guys have to do? But no, tons of stuff moving, but those are a couple of big things with the network right now.
And yes, I have a feeling that these Marvel series breakdowns are because I asked too many questions in our group about the Marvel Universe, and you guys just got together like, we're just going to have to make her a podcast for her to catch up.
You're supposed to be on it. I don't know. We'll have to talk about all that, and we'll get it all together. But thank you so much.
If I'm on it, it's going to be me just continuously asking, I have a question.
That's perfect. That's perfect. No, we can't thank Tamsin enough for her time today, and certainly go out and purchase The Hat Makers, as she mentioned. Find it at your independent bookstore, or you can also listen to the audiobook, which we all really enjoyed as well. So go out and find The Hat Makers by Tamsin Merchant, and thank you again to her. We can't say thank you enough. So for the Front Row Network, I am Craig.
I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Jeremy.
And we will see you in the front row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @FrontRowReviews with a Z.